Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's on. Well, first up, you're looking well, dude.
I am?
Yeah, you're looking really well.
Oh, thank you.
Fresh and youthful and happy. And
that's awesome.
It looks like the rock and roll lifestyle is treating you well.
I had some time off, actually. I think that's what it was.
Right, you had a little bit of a reset, a pause.
For sure.
A refresh.
Yeah, man. I just bought a house in Nashville, and I've just been, like, straight chilling, doing nothing over there. Just watching some horses feed on some grass and really taking it easy, just playing some music, writing a lot of music, and really decompressing. But we're only on, and this tour we're on here is only eight shows long.
Yep.
So
do you enjoy being outside in the wilderness, in the countryside, away from the urban chaos now at this stage in the journey?
You can't really hide from people when you're trying to, like, get your way into the world, and if you have something to say, but when you get there, it's good to hide away when you have every moment you can after the fact. Like, we tour a lot, and then, you know, after that, when I come home, I don't want to see anybody. I just nothing against anyone, just something against everyone.
Yeah. It's not personal. It's universal.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Do you have a wife and kids, or are you?
No. I have a girlfriend. I put off the wife and kids, definitely with, like, the band distracting me. My other members of this band have definitely had the opportunities to do that.
Jesse has four kids, right?
He does.
That's unbelievable.
I think while he was making them, I was mixing the albums and doing that shit. So.
Yeah, you're cooking up something else entirely, yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy because, for me, it's such a hard balance, the family life and the touring life. And anybody who can juggle those two things, I take my hat off to and admire wholeheartedly. I'm a single guy, and I think that being single, for me, perhaps for you as well, allows you to do what you do and be productive and creative and busy and focused and... I don't know. I don't have a choice.
I hear you, man. I definitely, I'm 47 now. You got me?
Yeah. I'm just cranking you up.
I'm 47. I can talk right here. I'm 47 now, and I've always kind of thought I would be a good dad, and I think I still do want kids. It's probably why I go out with younger girls. Just
keep that option open.
So we have a little time to figure that one out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the reason why I broke up with my ex, I think, is the clock hits, doesn't it, for women a lot earlier?
Yeah.
And they start thinking that way a lot sooner because they're like, I'm running out of options and time here.
Right. You don't want to mess with them, so get out of their way at that point.
That's exactly it. I want to talk to you about the formation of the band because, I mean, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, but okay. I guess the good place to start is there.
Yeah.
But before CKY comes into your life, are you just in the studio working as an engineer, or are you also doing professional music and touring?
Well, I've been recording bands since I was 13 for money. I got a four-track, if we want to go that far back. But
yeah, let's go all the way back.
Okay. Yeah, I did get a four track when I was a kid, and I was like the first kid who knew how to work it. And there really wasn't really bands per se, but we'd have like some kind of like, it was a bit of an independent music thing happening, like some type of new wave branch off in the early 80s. And like there was a couple kids who like had some synth sounds and some rock punk bands and hardcore bands, and like so I recorded a bunch of that when I was like in high school.
Anybody of sort of international notoriety, or is it more on a local level?
Oh, it's absolutely local level.
Right.
And then I eventually ended up, you know, working at a studio. When I met the guys in CKY, I had already been signed to a major label, dropped by a major label.
Are you a little bit older?
Oh, yeah. I'm like maybe 7 or 11 years older than that.
7 or 11.
Yeah.
Depending
on of those odd numbers. I forget. Yeah. One's my sister and the other's the band.
So you'd been in the ringer and experienced it.
Yeah. I came in with a vengeance. I had a real chip on my shoulder when I joined this band, and there was nothing going to stop me then, because I had the chance, you know, my band had got dropped and my record was shelved. I was in a band called Rudy and Blitz. We signed with Rough House Records. Rough House did the Fugees. Rough House did Cypress Hill. Rough House did a bunch of rap stuff. Then they did my drummer's band, other band, a band called Dandelion. And Dandelion was a really cool band in the late 90s. And my band, Rudy and Blitz, got a deal basically through knowing them. And then somehow our deal fell through, and I ended up with like... you know, my whole life was planned. I was about 26 at that point, or 23 when I had that. And then it fell through, and I didn't know what was happening after that. And I went out to California to try to, like, shop the record that I had been dropped from. I had no record deal, and I lost my band, and all I had was this record that I made.
Did you own it?
I did own it. It was yours. Yeah. And that was the only thing I got out of that. We worked for about a year and a half on this record, and we really had it. That band at that time, the sound of that band definitely was a good one. I don't think we would have had a problem doing okay if we had a record put out. So we were pretty good. Thank you. Somebody just brought in tea. Thank you so much.
It's all good. I leave everything in. It's a Gonzo podcast, so cool. Don't worry about interruptions or edits. We let the feelings flow.
So I went to California. I didn't know what I was doing there, and I had no idea. I went to Hollywood, and I ended up getting a job at a place called Jerry's Deli, delivering food in this real hip part of LA where a lot of record producers and industry was. And
whereabouts are we talking?
In Studio City, in Ventura, on Ventura Boulevard. Ventura Boulevard. That's a little Tom Petty. and
do you know Casey Chaos?
The radio DJ?
From Amen.
No.
He lives out there.
Oh, really? So Steven Adler used to call in, and I'd answer the phone. He'd order his chicken noodle, his chicken matzo ball soup from there. There's a place called Jerry's Deli. And incidentally, Andy Kaufman used to be a busboy there.
Wow.
Really cool shit. But so I didn't know anything about L.A. It was before cell phones. I was looking at this giant thing called a Thomas Guide for a map to try to deliver things. And all and I had CDs with me of my band. It was a really off way to think I was going to make it, okay? Alone, no band, CDs. The only person after working at this restaurant and barely getting anyone their food that I was able to deliver my CD to happened to be Tom Arnold, the ex-husband of Roseanne.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
A comedian, yeah?
Yeah, a comedian. So I don't know if he thought my CD was funny, but he sure as hell didn't have the ability to help me in the industry. So after, like... basically, I was living in my van with four animals at that time and delivering. I didn't get a deal in time, and I ran out of money in 3 months, and I went back. A few months later, then I started working at this studio, a 2-inch analog studio, producing, recording, engineering. I did some demos. Jess and our previous singer, Darren, heard a demo that I did for a band called Surge. And they wanted to record where that record was done. They wanted to do it at that studio. And I happened to be the engineer. So that was after losing a ton of shit. And then when they came in, they had some good ideas. And then they had a lot of time to do it. And they really wanted to do it right. So they came in with a project called Oil and another project called Foreign Objects, and there were two different types of things. Foreign Objects was kind of a more of a technical math kind of instrumental metal type of thing, and then Oil was what they would have called their sellout project. And to me, it sounded more like a Bush or something. And I happened to like the Foreign Objects stuff more than I like the Oil, and I was like, you know what? And they're like, we want to do two records. And I was like, well, why don't we make one record and make both of these things one and make Oil way cooler? And if you want to sell out with Oil, why don't we sell out with Foreign Objects and Oil? And then we put all of my shit from Rudy and Blitz together and all the harmony and, tonal stuff, and tried to develop an identity for the band and gave it a big thick sound until those riffs sounded right. They spent the right amount of time on them. We didn't really, we were just local guys, no deals or anything, and definitely cared about making very original music. If it sounded like anyone at the time, we were like, it has to go. We don't like, if it sounded like our favorite artist, we were like, it already sounds like they already did that. Yeah. So our goal was always to like alter it from that, and then we ended up just finishing that, and at the same time, bam, Jess's brother got was a pro skater, and then he got a deal to make a movie, a VHS film, a skate film that was his idea to combine it with his comedy and put his favorite songs in it and put his skating in it. So that ended up being the first CKY movie, was a follow-up to Jump Off the Building, a skate film. Bam got the good idea to just use our music as the soundtrack because it was probably far more affordable and didn't have to get any rights, and he already liked it, and it was a good help in his brother. So
keep it in the family, right?
Hell yeah, man. And we've always done that. And from the start, since that just worked, we never let anybody alter that method. We always produced every record ourselves. Since that first album, we never let anybody, it was always in the contract, and everybody's always okay with that. Although, maybe if we had worked with other producers and listened to other people and weren't so self-assured and cocky when we were so young, maybe we would have been bigger. We still, you know, we're all right. We've learned from those things in our later years. However, it might have held us down, but we were very honest, you know, and in the end, I can definitely attest that we were an honest band, just trying to do the right thing.
You can sleep soundly at night.
For sure.
And there's so much integrity there. And it's, I mean, you're the definition of a cult band, right? And I mean that as a compliment, in the sense that the brand, the image, the fan base, everything is self-made, and people who buy into it really buy into it. And it's something that I think is cherished by everybody who loves this band because of where it came from and the way the story unfolded.
Yeah, it was a natural progression. I mean, we just kept it in family and all our friends, and just kind of, I mean, we really, even at this stage, if you know, I am not, I guess it's a cult band. It's so cult that no one ever admits that they even liked CKY, you know, even in these days. Like, we don't hear too many artists or, you know, many people coming up to us telling us that we were a huge influence to them. We have a lot of of our audience telling us that, but I don't read much about it, like, you know, so maybe that someday we'll hear that we were of any effect to the actual music business or anything, but maybe there's some lessons to still be learned. We're still making mistakes, so who knows?
Well, certainly from a model point of view, like being in control of your own destiny. I mean, even when you were on the island in Def Jam, were you still calling the shots?
Absolutely. That was the only reason. Like, when we signed with Island Def Jam, that was after doing Volcom, and Volcom was such a homespun company and such an honest company.
Were they doing a lot of music, or was it just, I mean, that was a 50,
there was a, we were used to a 50-50 deal with, and Volcom did more work than we were doing at the time for us, and we were selling records, they were doing clothing, and they had their own record label run by Ryan Imigar from a really cool punk band called The Line in Orange County, California. And The Line ran this label called Volcom Entertainment, and Volcom Entertainment allowed us to do the first Warped Tour.
How was that?
The first Warped Tour was insane. We were driving around in my 1988 Chevy Astro minivan, And we had no label, no support, no nothing. And we weren't even officially on the tour. We snuck onto the tour because we had our friend's band, Volcom Entertainment, was allowed to have a stage on the very early Warped Tour. And we helped build that stage. And we would arrive in our van before the staging would even arrive at these venues. And we'd just park in an empty field. And then they would build the staging around the van and what we're sleeping in, and we'd wake up and there'd be half a festival kind of built, and we'd stumble over and give a bullshit hand on building the Volcom stage, barely any hand at all. And then we just wait around trying to play. And Kevin Lyman, who runs the Warped Tour, he kind of knew after a while we were on it, but he knew it was happening and we were doing okay and things were cool. But we had one backstage pass between us.
Amazing. So you got to hand it out and share it.
Oh, yeah.
Every time
and
someone
then
goes for a
by the time we figured out maybe we should make some copies over at Kinko's, which is a copy printing place in the U.S., Kevin Lyman saw one of us with a fake pass. And he booted us off that tour in 1999. But we were very much sneaking on the tour, and nobody knew who we were, and we were like,
is CKY won out at this point or not?
CKY Landspeed, the video, is what we were selling as merch. And I printed the first CKY t-shirts. Like, we were about to go out. We didn't even know. We were like, yeah, maybe we should print some shirts, like, last second. Because we were just like, Volcom said, do you guys want to come out on Warped Tour? It was like next week. Like, yeah, just sneak on, you know. And we were selling good with them, for the record. But, yeah, so Landspeed was out, and we made a bunch of bootleg copies of Landspeed, and me and Jess would just sit out there while people were walking in to the Warped Tour with their tickets saying, buy this video. This video's fucked. $10. Buy this video. We're like bootlegging our own movie to make some money for gas. And we did it again in 2000, and we got thrown off that tour as well.
What for that time?
That time it was because one of the amphitheaters that the Warped Tour was being held at needed to tax everyone 35% extra on merch. So everybody would have had to raise the merch prices a whole lot, and nobody would have bought anything. So we contested that, and we made a petition, wrong of our idea at the time. We made a petition, fuck the Warped Tour, at the Warped Tour.
On the Warped Tour.
Yeah. And we had people coming up to sign this massive petition, and it got ripped down and destroyed. And we got, like, kicked out, like, you know, with a foot, you know, that day.
Yeah.
But we went back to do the Warped Tour in 2017, the whole thing. We were on the main stage, and we've made good amends with Kevin Lyman. And
my friend said he saw you out at the beach one most recently. Was it last year?
Oh, yeah, yeah, the 25th anniversary. Yeah. We did one show in Atlantic City. Yeah, and that was fun.
It's been amended then. It's all good.
25 years. We played the Warped Tour in 99 and in 2019, so 20 years. Pretty cool. And that tour is just like, if you've been through it, Jesse will tell you if you ask him. It's like one of those things, like, you just don't, if you see somebody who's also been through Warped Tour, you just like kind of nod and like, you know, you've been through it together.
It's like being in the trenches.
Yeah.
Like going to war together.
Yeah, you go on really, you can go on at any time of the day.
Obviously, the heat a lot of the time is just blisteringly intense.
Non-stop. You have really no time to change over. It's on and off. No sound checks, just line checks for everyone. Nobody gets treated any better than the other person, any band. They swap the biggest bands with the little bands at, you know, main set times. It's a rough tour, and then there's a stretch where it's like 25 shows in a row with not a day off. So once you're at the end of that tour, you really get, you know, your legs on, you get toughened up. So it was great for us to do when we came back again after the Phoenix in 2017, you know, to kind of just, you know, work us out and get us back to, you know, being in shape again.
Yeah, it's like getting you match fit, isn't it?
Fuck yeah.
And then a little run like this is like a busman's holiday.
Right. Yeah. This Wild Hearts Backyard Babies tour has been fun. And
did you know either of these bands before this tour?
You know, Backyard Babies for sure, because of the Helicopters connection, and because we have played a couple festivals with them over the years. Over the recent years, we have played festivals with Backyard Babies, probably in the past as well. The Wild Hearts we have never played with, and I've heard little things about it over like time, but not I hadn't been familiar with the music, and I'm getting to listen to all this stuff, and they're, you know, it's crazy to hear about like some like serious rock and roll that's been around for 25 years that I hadn't known about. You know,
I just think they never made it out of England. They're so loved. They're like heroes
in the States.
In the UK,
it must not. Yeah.
It never translated, I don't think.
Right, no.
But it's interesting to me because if this tour was in the late 90s,
really
early
sweet
noughties,
guys, too. I mean, Danny, the bass player.
They're the greatest.
The stories that he has.
All of them.
Really, I mean, I told him, it was two nights ago, he said he was going to write a book. I said, man, nobody in the U.S. reads books. You got to put it on Netflix. That's what we want to see, you know what I mean? So hopefully they make a documentary I can watch when I get back.
They need to. I was actually speaking to a friend of mine who was going to do a book, and I was like, we should do a film.
That story about the groin that burst 25 feet of blood all over his room, and the leg amputation, his toes falling off, the 25 minutes of overdose, all types of stuff.
Well, I think all three bands have got a lot of war stories.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, you can tell, man. These leather jackets are far a little bit more beat than mine, I think.
What age did you start indulging?
You know, before I was in this band, but I didn't do any drugs or I wasn't like I drank in high school at parties and stuff, but I just was practicing my guitar, man. And at that point, I was kind of believing a lot of the 80s rock stars with their bullshit. Like in the US, it was like this program called Nancy Reagan's like Just Say No, and like rock stars got involved in that. Like you'd see like Ozzy like blitzed out of his mind telling you to say no to drugs, and like Gene Simmons was, I'm sure, sober at the time he was doing it. But you know, all of our, you know, rock stars that were big at the time were telling us not to do drugs, and I almost, you know,
seemed
I
like the party was over.
I was young. I believed it. There was no party for me because I was 14. You know, I didn't know what the party was. I knew that I wanted to be successful at that point. When kind of the thing, it started to shift into the 90s, and things started to get more dark. Like I was like the 80s. I was maybe I smoked a little weed, but once it started to hit the 90s and you were in a band, and if you kind of weren't like, if you weren't on heroin, you weren't even in a cool band at the time, it felt like, you know what I mean? And a lot of my friends are dead. My band members, my best friends, because of that feeling and because of what we thought we had to be like, to hear the music right or just to feel like that's all we cared about. So we really just wanted to do it right. So, following the drug patterns of our heroes was a huge mistake because, you know, I mean, like, they're fucking dead, you know, and all they wanted to do was just be a rock star or, you know, just play music, you know, so looped up into something that really had nothing to do with it for cool points. And, you know, in retrospect, at the time, I did that stuff. I snorted that stuff for about a month. I never shot it, but my friends in my grunge bands back then did, you know, and they're not here. So I knew that. I said to them, I said, dude, I'm leaving this fucking band if you guys start shooting that shit. And I walked into a rehearsal room and I saw it happening, and I was like, wow. And I packed my gear that fucking day, and then I joined that other band I told you about that did get a record deal, you know, and then I went and formed CKY. But I left that, you know, and I stuck with pot. I stuck with weed, you know. Marijuana never killed me, and I, you know, I still smoke it 24/7, unfortunately, you know, for my lungs, I guess. But, you know, I never went to anything harder than that after that. I did have a huge problem with Jack Daniels, you know. Oh, and pills, I forgot.
Downers, you know, or uppers?
Both at the same time.
Okay.
I was prescribed a lot of Adderall. I was prescribed Ritalin before, I was prescribed Adderall before people were talking about it, before it was like for college kids and shit like that. I was prescribed it because of, you know, just being a manic, like bipolar, you know, diagnosed manic bipolar guy since I was little, you know. But So I was on all that shit, and I was on Valium and Adderall at the same time. And the doctors didn't give a fuck back then. They'd give it all to you. So, and they thought it was pretty cool I was in a band, and they get to tell their friends. So they'd also give me anything I wanted. So Valium and Adderall, and for CKY shows, there was a recipe to get on a stage. And I don't think I played a CKY show. I don't think any of us played a CKY show sober until 2012.
2012.
Right.
So you had over
and it was the
decade.
final nail in the coffin, because one of us wasn't sober that show. And the rest of us were. And that was the end of that era. It wasn't due to the sobriety, but it was due to the embarrassment felt from being sober with someone from the past period.
Yeah.
And it was a misfit. And just our whole attitude, like, we were just a fucking wreck walking around on stage for 3 fucking hours talking shit, like, just blowing it. Like, the shows were terrible by then, you know? So we needed a minute off to rethink all that bullshit.
When did the wind truly catch the sail and things truly take off in a way that you felt like, oh shit, it's on, it's happening right
again,
now?
Again, or the first time?
The first time around.
The first time, from the minute Volcom got involved, like, because we were just a Philadelphia band, and Volcom started, like, and we also had no fucking money. I mean, well, they did. Jesse didn't. But me and Jess and Bam didn't have any money. They came from very little money. They were they weren't a very rich family at the time. And I was just like a homeless guy. I lived on the couch of the studio when I met those guys. So when we started to get free clothes from Volcom, and they were like rad skate clothes that were like they cost a lot of money in the store. Like, they were designer clothes. They're just sending me shit. And I was like, I'd rather wear some dirty shit from the thrift shop, but you know, I could sell that stuff, or I could wear it, or I could make my friends happy with it. And then they were like sending us to California. And so when we started to like go and play other places and like travel and just get free shit for being in a band, it started to feel real cool. And then
were you getting girls and drugs and all that offered on plates as well from the get-go?
From the get-go, that yeah. didn't you don't yeah well, I've always had no trouble with that. You didn't that's just a distraction from the band. I didn't get the, you know, maybe originally I got in a band for that stuff. You know, maybe not, you know, I can't even really remember. I probably not, because I was in a band since I was 7. I didn't.
You're just like a guitar.
I wasn't looking for pussy at 7.
No, I don't think anyone is.
Just my cat when it got lost around the house.
And obviously, Jackass was so ubiquitous with that time.
Jackass. And, oh, okay. There you go. So when that hit, and then people really, well, CKY2K got really big.
Yeah.
And I think about that time is when we really started to feel like successful. 2000. Warped Tour, we started to notice the crowd getting way bigger,
just a huge difference.
Yeah, we weren't like on the stage going, come on, come to the front, come on, get up here. Like, we used to have to build a crowd screaming to people from the back, because in the 99 Warped Tour, they might have set us up behind the porta potties, you know. We were just a real shit punk band, you know. So we were begging people to come watch us. That next tour in 2000, I think CKY2K had just come out, and we could really tell that we weren't trying to beg people to come up anymore. You know, so and selling a lot of t-shirts, we started to do well. Yeah, and by 2005, we all bought houses. So that was amazing. So I think and we also had massive drug and alcohol problems.
Whole band.
Yeah, the whole band. Everybody. And we would be the ones to tell you everybody else is fucked up. Can you believe those bands? Like, we had no idea we had a problem. None of us.
Is that because of the circles you were around and in?
Yeah, like, I don't know anybody
guys,
more.
Were you spending a lot of time with them? Because they were obviously running wild.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
So the whole thing was just kind of.
Just BAM in general.
Chaos.
Like, I mean, nobody is. I've never, ever met anyone more nuts than BAM. Like, legitimately, like, not nuts like nuts, but just like he can
out of control.
He does whatever he fucking wants, and that's his tagline. But he really does, man, whether you like it or not. And he's gotten away with it for quite a while, but we'll see. Life is crazy. You learn a lot of shit. But he's a mule. He's a tough motherfucker.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tell me about some scenarios where you barely escaped. Any come to mind? Either like local fucking townspeople trying to kill you or fucking promoters?
Well, back in the early days, I was just thinking about this the other day. We once got beat up by a whole skate team, me and Darren, outside of an audio skate video premiere in California. Darren and I got in a fight and we got beat up by 12 skaters and both ended up in the hospital next to each other, and they're just like flipping our wieners around looking to see if we had any damage, and we both wake up like, what just fucking happened? Yeah, we survived that one. That was right after a gig from Shit Talking, and I saw the gig online not too long ago. That's why I'm talking about it. We were so fucking wasted. Like, I try not to even watch any of our old shows, you know, because, like I said, there was a recipe to get on a stage, and I was up to, like, 10 Valium a night, but I would snort 2 Adderall, and if we weren't finished the first bottle of Jack, we wouldn't even leave the dressing room. I don't care if it was 2 hours late, you know what I mean? That is not how you treat your job or your audience or anything. And we were just so bloated in our minds. Yeah. Well, fuck ourselves. We deserved it. We were complete assholes.
I mean, that must be tough because at that time, so much of what was going on was being recorded and it's out there, isn't it? And so,
it's not necessarily out there. No, we didn't record any of that shit. That shit was behind the scenes, you know? The crazier shit's not on video.
Always.
Right.
Always.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's that, obviously, the scene, I mean, you probably get pulled up on it a lot, where you go to Gigi Allen's grave.
Right.
Is that something that haunts you and follows you?
Does it haunt me?
I mean,
at the time, you know, and I still think, you know, Gigi did some really interesting things for rock and roll. And when I did discover Gigi, I was at a point where I thought I knew everything about rock and roll, and I thought I knew the top, and I thought I knew the bottom. And I thought I knew the limits. And when I discovered Gigi, I realized I didn't know the limits. And I was the type of guy who wanted to know the limits.
And maybe push them.
So when I did discover Gigi, luckily, because I would have maybe ended up there, I knew that Gigi, I set Gigi as the limit. And I never wanted to do Gigi. So I could have been a horrible thing, but Gigi did it already.
Yeah.
So I respected that, and he showed me like how far you can push it with just calling it rock and roll or doing it for rock and roll. Like, you can really just like go nuts in front of people and like do awful things, do great things, do just push the shit out of it calling it rock and roll. I mean, you know. And that's cool. It's The excuse, he showed me the limits of the excuse of the word rock and roll. You know, using rock and roll as an excuse for your bad behavior.
Yeah, I was going to say that's exactly what it is, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
And I needed an excuse for my bad behavior all my life, you know.
Isn't it wild that Todd Phillips, his first
so
ever
great.
Film,
and that's is one of the only guys that get me to go to a theater, you know.
And now he's made The Joker and obviously right. billions of dollars all over the world.
Todd
Hangover
Phillips,
films.
Yeah.
That's crazy, isn't it?
His college film, Hated, which I have an original copy, VHS, because I knew one of Todd's editors back then, and he's like a East Coast guy. But he's gotten so fucking successful from starting out with my favorite rock documentary as his college film. Like, my absolute favorite rock and roll documentary is G.G. Allin, Hated. It's a must-see rock and roll documentary. And keep watching after the credits, too. So Todd Phillips did that movie, and he knew the Joker before, like, you know, the Joker. Like, his perspective of it is very good.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell me about being in the studio to make Infiltrate, Destroy, Rebuild.
Uh-huh.
Was that an exciting time creatively with a bit of money behind the band? And
well, that's the contract, like I told you. When we signed with Island Records, I said, okay, well, I have to produce the records. We have to produce, self-produce them. And we have to go to Hawaii. And we want that in the record contract. They're like, well, we don't really, like, that doesn't, like, we don't put trips to Hawaii in a record contract. And we're like, well, we want it in the contract. So we've got a trip to Hawaii, whatever that meant. Probably just came out of the advance, like, whatever. And then a decent advance, and we got to record the album in Hawaii. We did the album in Honolulu, most of it, mixed it in Hollywood or Westlake, at Westlake Audio.
Did Hawaii treat you good? Was that a...
Hawaii was great, but when we went, we were scheduled to fly out on September 12th, 2001. You know what that day is.
Of course.
So we had to postpone our flight. None of us knew even if there was a reason at all to get on a flight at that time. No idea. Why would we? And is it dangerous? And how many days left with the planet at that point? We didn't know what was happening. And we were scheduled to fly out on the 12th. We postponed it to the 14th. So there we are, the 14th, trying to start an album with that right over our heads 3 days before. September 11th, I'm talking about. And so we're just kind of trying to start a record and the newspapers, and we're just reading news. And I just remember the engineer reading the news, and they were like bagging the newspapers, afraid that they were coated in a chemical. There was all types of fear going on, really. So we were like under this massive guise of fear, trying to distract ourselves with that record. And that's what we were doing. That's how we distracted ourselves. We were there for 3 weeks. And when I said that, I just got dizzy from the amount of rum and alcohol that we drank. I feel a little hungover from just that trip today, 25 years ago. But we were making
that rum hangover is a specific kind of hangover as well, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it has, like, I got dizzy, I think, because we got island fever. Mm-hmm. Is what, when you go to Hawaii and you stay there for too long, it's like there's something called island fever where you just like start to get a little disoriented and you like have to get back to the mainland. It's like being on a boat all of a sudden. You know, I feel like that right now. Like, I feel like I'm on the ferry just thinking about it. But so we got back, got out of there and finished the rest of the record out of there. We went back to mix. We mixed Flesh in the Year back in Honolulu, actually. So, and that's the best sounding song on that record. So I mixed that in Honolulu.
What kind of an immediate effect did September the 11th have on, like, touring bands and the live music industry at that time? You remember? Obviously, it had a global impact, but just
I mean, it changed everything. Like I said, like, we didn't know how long we had left, and everything was very immediate, and everything felt very honest. We all felt connected. There wasn't this bloated Instagram, like, addiction to fame. Nobody felt famous. Everybody felt equal. There was no fame, and, like, there wasn't levels of people, even past money, it felt like. You know, people were people for a minute, and everyone's forgotten that, And if it has to take some goddamn awful catastrophic event to make people see that again, it's a damn shame. But, everybody's so up their own asses with the fucking fame, desire for fame. There's never been more of a time to reject that. If you want to be famous, don't be famous.
Well, now as well, people yourself. Want to be famous just for being famous. Like it used to be, you'd have a craft and then you'd become famous off the back of that craft. Now, the craft is fame. Do you know what I mean?
Such a cheesy distraction from reality. I can only imagine who would want to be famous September 14th, 2001? It sounds stupid.
A fucking nihilist or narcissistic asshole.
Yeah, that's stupid kind of person. Shit. So try to put yourself into reality.
Did you ever get bitten by that bug once you started to get some success yourself and feel things were...
It goes away. We can't keep that sense of reality constantly. It's depressing, and especially when others don't follow. So just trying to deal with the rest of the world, you have to kind of put yourself into a state of confusion, and you lose yourself. Yeah, we constantly have to come back and remind ourselves what's going on. I think that our sense of perspective personally with me and Jess and stuff and CKY-related stuff, we've never been more clear on what's happening. I mean, at this point, we're just a two-piece band.
Tell me about that friendship, that brotherhood with you and him.
We don't argue. I mean, I don't really know how to even describe that. It's just, it's much easier. It's just natural. We do this naturally, and it was a little bit more of a struggle before, kind of trying to beg people to be on your page or trying to figure people out. And all those people just kind of drop off eventually. Like, we're not struggling to be ourselves. We're very comfortable with that. And I think that's who's left, you know? It's easier to do. This is what we do when we wake up. Just we're not begging each other to do this.
Did you go down the rabbit hole together and come back out at the same time together? Or was there a little bit of discrepancy with those individual journeys when it comes to, like, you know, the partying and the...
Yeah, Jess likes his beer, and he still does. So when Jess goes out after the shows to, like, indulge in a lot of drinking, I'm normally not there.
Are you done with drinking? Do you not drink at all?
Well, I don't drink whiskey anymore, and I drink very, very little. Honestly, I probably drink once maybe every 3 months, and I don't even have the attention span to sit with a drink long enough to remember I have one to even get a buzz. Like, I forget I even poured one. So it might be because of the amount of weed I'm smoking, you know. And I don't want to get dizzy, so I smoke weed. You drink,
and that's what works for you.
Yeah. It's not necessarily that it works, but every time I smoke it, I hope it works.
Yeah,
I don't know if it ever does, you know, but I'm still hoping it will.
And you're happy with the effects that it has, and you're comfortable.
No, I'm pretty disappointed with the effects mostly. So I keep trying to find the best kind of weed, but like I said, that's the drug addict in me, you know, search for the proper high. It's just an escape from everybody. Like I said, you know, like things and everybody. Like, how mad can you be? And a substance shouldn't be the thing you rely on to take you away from that. So if anybody wanted to call me, you know, a drug addict, I would be addicted to weed in a way that I smoke it a lot because it gives me a small escape for a second, and it cures my nausea or stomach aches and tons of other things. So gives me an appetite. Sometimes, you know, I don't want to eat. So there's a good benefit from it all, and it keeps my mind distracted, and it hasn't really ruined anything too terribly yet. It's fucking legal, like, all over the states, you know?
Yeah.
Not in my fucking city, though. I buy a house in a city that doesn't have legal weed. Who'd figure?
What took you to Nashville? The music scene? Surroundings? The seclusion?
No, because it's funny. As I moved to Nashville, and I haven't once gone into the city in 7 months. 8 months? Not once.
Could get a lot of work out there as an engineer or producer, right?
I could, yeah. I just haven't been trying to do all that. Like I said, like, I really like just hiding away and just I make a little like a little studio real comfortable, and I'm just in there I'm in there smoking weed, twisting knobs, playing with, I have tons of guitars and basses and drums, and I don't ever get out of my comfy pants, you know. That's what I'm really
living
doing.
The dream, brother.
Yeah.
I guess, as you say, when you get off the road, you want that time to decompress, chill the fuck out, and
yeah. And I didn't. I didn't buy a house over my limits, and I don't live out of my means, and I don't drive fancy cars, and so the reason I bought my place in Nashville is because anywhere in the States at this moment, for decent real estate, Nashville's a wise investment at the moment for a good priced house. Houses are really expensive all over the U.S. I lived in California for 15 years, and just the state of the world. I don't want to be in a crowded city in panic, and I don't want to be around terror, or I don't want to be around anyone panicking in any situation. So I don't like the stress in a big city. So Nashville, cheap enough, tons of land. I don't see a single house where I'm at unless I, you know, go.
Get the binoculars out.
Go a couple hundred yards.
Nice.
Yeah.
What happened with Darren, if you don't mind me asking?
That was 10 years ago. He quit the band in 2011. So 9 years ago. And then we ended up getting Daniel Davies in 2012 to fill in, and then Jess and I did Fuckface Unstoppable with Bam.
And what was that like?
Insanity. That was the first time I ever had to leave a tour.
It was dark, or just too chaotic.
It was dark, dangerous, scary as hell. Australia, Fuckface, Unstoppable Tour, Bam Margera's punk band, I guess, where I felt like kind of Bam was kind of pushing it. Like I said, Gigi set the limit, and I think Bam was trying to go past that, and I didn't appreciate that, you know, because I was a Gigi fan, and I don't want my friend Bam to fucking do that shit, because I don't, like, the fact that Gigi did it, that's good enough, man. Like, he's dead for that shit, you know what I mean? I don't want my friend Bam to die from that shit. And Bam was kind of pushing at that tour, and he was really going hard. The hardest tour, the tour manager wrote a write-up on that tour somewhere online of Bam Margera's Fuckface Unstoppable 2012 Australia tour. And it's just insanity. So I didn't want to come back with a body bag, and I was positive that Bam was trying to go out that way in Australia. So I quit the band due to the fact that I was afraid that Bam was going to die on the tour, and the fact that I had to do the same drugs to keep up with that tour. Every night we'd get thrown out of a hotel. Every night, I'm talking two or three times a night, we'd keep checking the different hotels. That's exhausting, and there's not a minute to sleep when you're doing it. He's just moving the party around, and he's like a Pied Piper running around, and they're groups of just like the worst humans on earth following him around, you know. And I was playing guitar in the band, and I had to go with that tour, and I didn't at that time. I was trying to be sober. I knew CKY had a lot of trouble, and then we were breaking up, we were falling apart at that time, so I was trying to be sober. So I quit that band to for my sobriety, and reformed CKY in 2016 with a good head. And we were ready at that point. And then we went to Dave Catching's studio at Rancho de la Luna to record that record, because I felt really good when I went there. I visited Rancho de la Luna with a friend's band who was recording, and the vibe was great.
It's such a vibey place.
Right.
It feels like magic's just capable air.
It does. And if you listen to all those records, magic is capable, it sounds like, in the air, you know, there. So you never know if it's going to come to you, but it's a good spot to start. And
did you have the material ready to go, or were you going there with the intention of creating?
Yeah, we had
there?
5 days booked, so we didn't have time to screw up.
Right.
I would love to go and hang out at Dave's and freeform some shit, or like Desert Session style, you know, like he gets to do, you know, but
But what people don't realize is, and they obviously can't see the room that we're in now, but if you imagine like a dressing room size or a lounge room, the studio is not a lot bigger than this, is it?
Yeah, it's
there's
a small
like
ranch
bed
house.
Down there, like the kitchen, and then there's like the room where you jam and play, and that's kind of it.
It's a small ranch house, and you walk right into the control room. That's the
yep.
the foyer,
it's the first
the living
thing you
room.
See
yeah.
when you go through the door, isn't it?
Really small, but such legendary records made there. The same equipment, you know, the drum set that's on all of those records is there, and you know, the vibe is great. We stayed there for 5 days and worked as quick as we could. And then
was that the first time you'd worked with another producer?
No, Dave.
Was Dave,
not Dave wasn't there at the time. Actually,
oh, okay.
Dave was on tour with Eagles at the time.
Right.
So no, I produced that. We had one of Dave's friends there to help with the engineering, John, and then we took the tracks out, and then you know, then I screwed them up or you know, mixed them or made them good or bad elsewhere. You know, in the mix process, but. I would have loved to do it solely there. It wasn't mixed there, but it was recorded there. So
it's quite an upbeat, positive, optimistic album, and now I'm learning why. Because I think the thing with CKY, which I love, and I think the reason everyone loves the band, is this kind of somber, low-key, moody vibe to a lot of the material. But there's some tracks on that record, even the song about having a breakdown or being close to a breakdown.
Right.
It's a positive, life-affirming,
well, my vibe in
upbeat tune.
Yeah, thanks. My vibe in CKY, just musically, is always to kind of mix. I think the best stuff has sad and happy at the same time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you can hit that mark,
sappy,
sappy. But you know, in any way, it could be sappy in an awful way. Tonally, it can be. Musically, the texture can change. It can be heavy, it can be loud, it can be soft, but it can still be sappy in all those forms. You can have something extremely heavy that's sappy in a way, but it's got to kind of break your heart in a way, somewhere in there, maybe just for the smallest second. Maybe it's just one note that comes by and does it, you know, or you know, it's got to make you like just smell something or feel something or hurt for a minute or just the slightest bit. So if it's one direction or the other, I don't stick with it. I can't do the saddest of shit. I can't do the happiest of shit. But if there's just that, if it, that's all I'm ever searching for in the songs. So I think we nailed that on a lot of stuff, and I'm fine with that. You know, we have, my problem over the years has been a lot of layering, and problem to me, maybe not to others, but to some listeners, can absorb so much sound at once, I think, and I've always been trying to fight to get to find a way to simplify the music to still make it have that, but it's kind of like textures and melodies and counter melodies and stuff is what creates the hurt for me.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah,
hard
yeah.
to take away some of these layers, and I've been struggling for years trying to, but you know, and I've heard people be able to do it. Even like John Frusciante can do it by accident, you know, and certain people with
that guy's a
limited,
fucking wizard.
Like very little instruments. Yeah, you know, he can pull it all with almost just one instrument can make that happen, you know. So there is a way to do it.
Did Richie Kozin teach you guitar? Is this true?
Yeah, Richie Kozin I took lessons from when I was 18. I wasn't just starting, but yeah, Shrapnel Records, Mike Varney. Was a guy who put out a ton of Shredder records in the 80s, and that's all I listened to was Paul Gilbert and Joey Tafola and Racer X, well, Racer X Records and fucking Tony McAlpine and Richie Kotzen's. And Richie Kotzen is an amazing singer after the fact, but I listened to him as a guitar player. And he's also in the Winery Dogs, and he joined Poison and kind of took CeCe's place back in the day. Got kicked out. Yeah, Richie Kotzen was from Pennsylvania, where I'm from.
Right.
And I just ran into him at the supermarket at the Ralph's in Studio City not too long ago. And I was like, hey, he's like, let's go have a coffee one day. I was like, I don't want a coffee. I just want more lessons. I want singing lessons now, you know, fuck the guitar lessons.
How did you find stepping up?
Singing?
Yeah. You enjoy it?
Yeah, like dude, it? I'll take any challenge on my, like, I'll take any job. You don't want the job? Fine, I'll do it. Like, that's how I am. Like, all right, oh, you don't want to do it? I'll do it then. Fuck it. I'll do it. I don't care. Like, if I want to do something and you're in my way and you ain't doing it right or you don't want to do it or you're bitching about it, I'll do it. I don't want to hear you bitching about it. So I'll do it. I never wanted to do it. Never my goal to do it. Was never my goal to do it. I always wanted to be in the back. I liked being the guy that behind the curtain, you know, like I'm a producer, you know, I wore a mask in this band when I joined because of that. You know, I took it off. I should have kept it on, man, knowing how fucking popular mask bands would become.
Right, yeah.
And how I would extend my career far. Maybe I'll start again.
You need a few more members, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We were one, and I was the only guy in the band wearing a mask and looking weird before Limp Bizkit had that dude doing it, before Wes was doing it. So I was doing it out of embarrassment for the musicians I had just joined up with, because I was in cooler local bands than what I had just joined. And I didn't want anybody to be like, fuck, Chad fucking is playing with these losers from fucking the suburbs.
I think Wes's reasons are the same, probably, to be honest, his embarrassment about Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, right? It's possible, yeah. I mean, so, yeah, man. I mean, I love Wes, actually. He's great.
He's a great guy. I know him very well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very open about his feelings on that band.
At one point, we were trying to get his brother to play synth in CKY.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Because they do the Black Light Burn stuff together, don't they? Or is it Big Dumb Face?
Big Dumb Face, I do remember. Yeah. We were in Jimmy Iovine's office, and he was showing us the Big Dumb Face video because we were about to sign with Interscope. I just remember seeing that. Like, we were the first ones to see that shit. So,
it was a crazy time, man. The record business, as we now know it, is a totally different thing, isn't it? It's gone.
It's gone. I mean, it's gone.
You got to see the last hoorah, right?
There are labels, and they help bands, you know, who don't want to go hiring, you know, people to promote their records for themselves and making their own imprints and keeping track of numbers and blah, blah, blah. They help, you know, they help a band get a record started. If you can get a small budget and you don't have one or something, you don't necessarily need a label in any way, obviously. But to promote your band, you do need someone out on the street that knows other people to talk about it. So you have to hire that person or something to tell them. You can be your own label, though, these days. And social media is not the greatest thing. I mean, social media is a huge lie. There's so many bands with massive followings online that couldn't sell 4 tickets in any city.
Yep.
Yet they think they would, and they hear their and every fan on there is like, come to Wichita, come to, you know. And then they get there. There's nobody there. Those fans are full of shit. They ain't coming out. You know why? Because they're on the fucking computer.
Yep.
Bullshitting.
I love you, man. I'm your biggest fan. It's like, well, buy a record then. Don't just like my Instagram post.
It's not buy a record. I don't care if you buy a record. I care if you go to a show.
Yeah.
I want you to go to a show. That's the most important thing as far as what I do is like, I only got in a band. Like, I love recording. When I'm done a record, I never listen to it again personally because I've listened to it so much making it. But touring is what I really do is like, I like to travel and I like to play music and get into it and feel it and be out there and if the audience is there, then they should damn have a great time and if people aren't coming to the show, then the buck stops here, you know. So we'd stop right now if nobody's
it would
to the
all
show.
be done and dusted. Yeah. Yeah, it's the last bastille of income, isn't it?
Right. I mean, income or not, we don't half the time. Sometimes we make money, sometimes we don't. That's just touring. We do it because we love doing it. If it keeps us busy, you know, gets me out of the house, I'll keep doing it. If people are there, I'll keep doing it. I'm not trying to get rich. That's not the illusion. It never would be. I'd make more money working at Burger King in the States, minimum wage, at times in this business. It's up and down. This is not a real job. It's just not. I'll keep making music. You can do things on the side. It depends how lavish a life you want to live, man. If you can find that perfect way to live where you can do this, that's what I've done, you know?
Well, a lot of people fucked up by getting married so many times and then divorced, and then all the women take half their shit, isn't it? That's kids, a lot of those guys.
Yeah, like I said, kids from and wives, that era. Right. I don't have the kids and wives, so maybe I have more savings because
less overheads.
Less overheads. Yeah, that's what
a couple of things I wanted to pick up on before I let you go, Chad. First of all, is Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
What happened there? It was Chinese Democracy tour.
Yeah.
Did you get to do any shows with them in the end? What happened?
We've talked about this one a lot over the years. We did. There was 18 shows on the Guns N' Roses 2002 tour we did with them. Axl asked us to come out, which was the hugest compliment. We couldn't believe it. and we were a band with a terrible attitude, and all of a sudden they threw us into amphitheaters and stadiums opening for Guns N' Roses. It started with a riot in Vancouver, Canada. Axl didn't show up. We played that show. So on that tour, we did 17 shows, and Axl did 16 out of 18. So we played more shows on his tour than he did.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so you're basically, was the riot happening whilst you guys are on, after?
The first day the riot happened because Axl wasn't showing up. I mean, it was 2 hours after.
So you guys were all right. You did your show.
We had already played, yeah.
Yeah. You were on time.
Our bus was parked with Guns N' Roses buses. So when the riot happened and they started pulling the chairs and everything out of the venue to throw at the buses, our bus was getting pummeled with the chairs. And they're like, the touring crew told us next time, we'll let you guys know beforehand so your bus doesn't get damaged next time. If Axl's not going to show, we'll tell you. But before, so when we hit Philadelphia 17 shows later, which is our hometown, it wasn't the end of the tour. It wasn't supposed to be the end of the tour. But Axl, again, did not show up. We did a sold-out Madison Square Garden show in New York City. The next night was Philadelphia at the Spectrum, the first Union Center. It became, I'm not sure what it's called now, but it's where I saw all my concerts as a kid. CKY played. We got the word, Axl's not showing up. Get your bus out of here. And we wanted to see the riot. We knew there was going to be one, and especially in Philly, we wanted to see this shit. Because that's where you want to see a riot. But I mean, I don't want to see a riot, but if you had to watch what one might look like, you could just watch after or before an Eagles game or whatever. But they rioted, and all those windows and shit were getting smashed. They smashed a $1 million mixing console. The entire crew, Axl's entire crew, quit that day. We got our bus out of there, but like I said, we circled on I-95, the highway right next to the venue, and just made the bus circle so we could keep watching what was happening. So we're just circling around the venue on the highway trying to get a good watch. And then that was the end of the tour. We never saw Axl again after that, never heard from him.
Did you interact with him on the tour?
Yeah, Axl.
What was he like to you guys?
He was super cool to us. He was funny. And we were told when we first got on that tour, don't even look him in the eyes when he walks in the hallway. Keep your head down. Don't make eye contact. You know what? We weren't going to take that bullshit. That's a human being. And I don't think that's even Axl saying that. I think that's the motherfuckers who work for him.
Yeah.
And they're the ones making him look bad. And it was probably half of those fuckers who work for Axl making calls for him and this and that shit, talking for him, that made him look way worse than he was. Because as a dude, he was rad. He was real nice to us, and we didn't deserve to be on his tour. We weren't that big of a band. We got to play sold out Madison Square Garden. You know, I tell that story all the time to anybody. If like they never heard of my band or anything about rock and roll, I can just say, well, I played sold out Madison Square Garden, you know,
like the garden, baby.
Yeah. So shit. But yeah, I mean, Axl was a cool dude to us. I'm not sure. I think he got a bad rap, honestly.
Why do you think he just didn't show up?
I'm not talking about
shows,
those braids though. Either.
Yeah, the corn rolls.
Right.
How come you think he just didn't show up those times? I mean, it's a weird mindset, isn't it?
I heard he was hanging with a girl watching the game.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
He had a better place to be.
But, but Axl at the time had these gurus that he listened to all their...
whispering in his ear. And
yeah, they would give him advice. And maybe it was good advice because truthfully, look at him now. He's just fine. He's on top of the world. He's fucking Axl Rose. And he knew that. He didn't have to put up with anybody's shit. So what harm did it do him, you know?
That's a rock star right there, isn't it? There aren't many of them.
Yeah,
left.
Yeah, and y'all ain't like that, so don't try it. We're not gonna act like that.
And finally, Hetfield, Metallica.
Yeah, yeah. James Hetfield asked us.
That was another personal invitation, right?
Personal invitation from Hetfield to open up on his first show back in his hometown from rehab after the St. Anger. Like that documentary,
Some Kind of Monster.
Some Kind
of
Monster, yeah. That period, right when he got out of rehab, he was sober Hetfield, and we were fucked up CKY.
Yeah.
And he invited a real fucked up CKY.
Did he know that about you?
Fuck no, but right. Probably when he met us, and we never heard from him since. Big mistake there. Hey, Jess.
What's up, dude?
So, yeah.
And
man.
He treated you good, and it was a good time?
We played one show with them. We'd love to do 1,000 more though.
Well, if he's listening.
Yeah. Hey, James. CKY is still around.
Dude, thank you so much for your time.
Cheers, thanks,
Mark. Really enjoyed that, and I look forward to hanging out over the next few days.
Cheers.
Thank you.